With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter. This week we are talking to Rachel Edwards about her new column in the Sunday Times and life as a black woman in the countryside. We meet journalist Raphael Rowe, who is wrongly convicted for murder and now spends his time investigating the world's toughest prisons. And Brenda Davis tells us an incredible story that features in her new book. First up, it's Rachel Edwards.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast.
I mean, who did let the dogs out? Who let the producers in is the other question we've got to ask here. We are talking to author Rachel Edwards, who recently wrote a fantastic column for The Times all about why more black and Asian people should own dogs. As somebody who is a dog owner, I think everyone should own a dog. But Rachel, tell me, why do you think everyone should own a dog?
Well, hello there, Harriet. Well, I do think that people should. Although I wouldn't say the same thing about 20 years ago, because I used to be terrified of dogs. I was so scared of dogs growing up. Now I'm a very happy dog owner to one Cassie, a golden retriever who's absolutely lovely and I adore. But I never thought I would be, you know. And I think that culturally, it wasn't something we did in our family. And also my cousins and friends and other people from, I'm half Jamaican, half Nigerian, and people in our cultural circle didn't really own dogs. So it seemed very much an English thing that wasn't part of my world, really, when I was growing up. So I'm very delighted now to be a very happy dog owner, you know.
Why do you think it is such a sort of traditionally English country thing, isn't it, to be a bit crazy about our pets and particularly about dogs? Do you think it sort of changed how you relate to your community? Because one of the things that I noticed when I got a dog was that suddenly everybody smiled at me. When I was out walking the dog, everyone smiled at you. Everyone wants to talk to you.
That is so true, because I grew up, whilst I didn't have an urban upbringing, so I didn't grow up in London, I grew up in Hertfordshire, but I moved out to Oxfordshire from London, which is quite a big change. We live in a very rural community now, in a hamlet by the Thames. And actually, once I met my now husband, when we go out, you're right, it's a way of people connecting. So often, actually, even now, I know people's dogs maybe more than I know the other other people in the community, you know. So people say hello to Cassie and my dog before they say hello to me. And it's not personal, it's just that that's where people are. And I thought that, used to think that's kind of it's a mad English thing, but now I quite like it, because it's actually that these wonderful, unjudgmental creatures just saying hello to each other. And then you do then chat to the owners, and it's a really relaxed way of being and living in the countryside. So I'm very glad that I've got over my massive phobia and managed to embrace this side of country living. It's part of being out here, really enhances it, yeah.
Love it. The other column I wanted to talk to you about, because it was, I mean, you write it and as you're reading it, you sort of go, this must be fiction because it's so dramatic. And it wasn't, it was real life, is about racial profiling and when it happened to you. Can you tell us the story?
Yes, I certainly can. So, right. So for a start, I have had some comments about this, and people saying to me, did this really happen? And I had to flag this up straight away, saying, I'm an author, so if I need to make up fiction, I'm just getting a book. When I'm writing a column, it really is very much real. So what happened to me was, when I left university, I moved out to Oxfordshire, and my degree was in French and English, so I gave some French tuition to supplement my income in a kind of low-level publishing job. And I was teaching a 13, 14-year-old boy, and I went to teach, giving him French tuition. And one day, I turned up a little bit early, so I was waiting in my car outside, and I saw this kind of elderly white gentleman kind of clock me a bit and just saying, oh, I was sitting in my car reading these kind of verb books, and he just looked at me. And I thought he looked like he thought I was a bit suspicious. I didn't really think too much of it, but then I went on into the house, gave this lesson, and within half an hour, and the elder brother of my tutee burst into the room and said, ah, it's a helicopter above the house, you know. And I was so utterly shocked. And that bit's a bit of a blur, but then the next thing I remember is a policeman burst into the sitting room and looked at me, and obviously two people were going on, and he just apologised, and he didn't explain, he ran off again. And I was so shocked, so what had happened, the old man had called the police because he thought I looked suspicious. So, yes, that was my story. And then what happened was that... you know, they went away. They apologised after, well, they kind of explained after that there'd been a spate of burglars in the area. But my abiding memory is the fact that I was just sitting there in my car, and the only thing about me is that I was an incongruous burglar, black woman in my car in a very white English area, and that's why they'd call the police. So that was, that was my tale, really.
I mean, and even them saying, you know, there's been a spate of burglaries in the area. Well, so...
Yeah, exactly. And the presumption was that, therefore, because I somehow appeared suspicious. And really, and I actually, in my column, I'm 5'2½. Look, I have to look pretty good, but I was reading a French textbook in a very unremarkable black hatchback called Betsy. You know, it really wasn't threatening. And the fact that, I mean, it's comical now. I mean, I could have went at the time. I think I've humiliated and shocked, but actually, my abiding memories of the lady whose son I was teaching being incredibly kind and silently outraged and being on my side, and that kindness restayed me. So people who kind of take your side in the when injustice occurs, I think that's really important. She was very kind to me, so that's what sticks to me, really.
How does that make? What does that teach you, or did it teach you about racial profiling here in the UK? Was it a sort of moment for you where you were like, ugh, I knew this had to happen at some point and here it is? Or was it that, oh my gosh, I can't actually believe this is happening?
Well, I couldn't believe it was happening. And even now, a good reason, I still can't believe it happened, because I think that I was raised to, you know, be polite, to toe the line in a certain way. My father's a GP, my mother's a nurse. So both of them, between them, worked for NHS for well over 50 years. They were law-abiding and people who believed in integration. So they came, Windrush generation, you know, and they believed in education and kids blending in and doing your best. So I didn't live this kind of edgy life where I was used to police interventions in my life. It was the first time I think anyone's ever, I'd even seen a policeman close up. But I was so shocked. So it did shock me. And I felt somehow that for the first time I realised that just my skin colour could lead me to find myself in certain situations that were beyond my control, regardless of education or intelligence or behaviour. And that was a shocking thing, because that was something I couldn't have controlled myself. And even now, that resonates. It makes you think, okay, I don't want to happen to people who have maybe... I wouldn't want that to happen to anyone else, because I've absorbed it, I've moved on, and I'm in a position where I can talk about it. But it happens to people, young black people, all the time. And I feel for it. You know, it makes me realise how important it is that should not happen.
Yeah. There's been lots of chat recently about how white publishing is and how difficult it is for black people, particularly black women, to even get published in the first place. And one of the things that I don't know if you saw going around, but was a spreadsheet where people filled in how much they were given as an advance, and their kind of, you know, whether it was fiction, non-fiction, their ethnicity, their age, their gender, etc., etc. And, you know, the thing that came across very clearly was that there was both a gender and an ethnicity pay gap in terms of how much authors are making. What's your experience of publishing been like?
Well, I have to be very honest. I think behind the curve, maybe, that there was this, what am I being paid type thing going around on social media, which I think is a good thing, by the way. I think it's bring it out there, let's see what's going on. I'm very lucky in that I'm with Fourth Estate. They're my publisher, who are the imprint of HarperCollins. And my editor, Anna Kelly, has always championed Bain Publishing, because she started the prize with The Guardian about to promote unrepresented voices. So I do think there's huge room for improvement. And I've joined the Black Writers Guild. I'm not sure it's something you've heard about, but Bernadette Aristow and those Joyce teams, and a number of key authors, quite a few of us have joined this guild. This is streets of publishing and say, okay, we need greater representation, because it is an issue. Within my own publisher, I actually think that personally I've been looked at very well, and they have into what I wanted to do, and I've had free reign to write what I want to write. But that is not the case across the board. I know that for a fact. I'm talking to other authors, and they've had some very difficult experiences. So I'm very much for, you know, championing other people, getting their voice out there in the way they want to express themselves. And, change needs to happen, certainly.
Mm. And finally, I wanted to ask you about your column tomorrow, because it's such a good one. You were on Deal or No Deal.
I was, I know, and I it makes me laugh even now thinking about it. It was the craziest thing. Yeah, absolutely. So I think you've seen this column, and that's how I got my first house. And it's, that's, again, a bizarre story, but I have these bizarre but very much true stories going on in my life. So yes, that's my story of how I won my first flat, and I couldn't afford a mortgage, and I googled, you know, win TV cash, and that's what happened. I ended up on this game show that hadn't not yet aired, and within a few days, I was staring into Noel Edmonds' eyes being asked Deal or No Deal, and I'll never forget it.
What was it like? Because it was obviously, as you said, you were on it before it even aired, so it was before the kind of madness when everyone was obsessed with it and all strategizing. Yeah. Were you on it thinking, this is the most bizarre show, I don't know if anyone's going to watch it?
Oh, I was, because, you know, we had this, because it hadn't started, but I was the fourth ever contestant, and it hadn't aired, so we hadn't seen it. We didn't even see the set. We were the first people to ever see the set. And we practiced this with warehouse or aircraft hangar almost. And when we went on to it, and we didn't even know who the presenter would be, so Noel came on, and he was absolutely brilliant. But I thought, no one's going to watch this. It's completely crazy. I'm just opening these boxes. Who's going to watch this show? And then now, and I've watched it since, after I won my money, I've seen people have these incredible crazy schemes of, you know, how to predict what they're going to win, and all these superstitious ways of working out and strategies. It's fascinating. At the time, we didn't know. We just opened boxes and hoped for the best. And luckily for me, it worked.
It's a fabulous story, and I'm absolutely loving your columns and time. So thank you so much for writing it. Rachel,
thank you so much.
Thanks for chatting to us tonight. It's been lovely to talk to you. It's Rachel Edwards there, author and columnist in the Sunday Times. You just can tell from that she's going to be a font of brilliant stories. So I'm going to be looking out for her every week.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast. You can get in touch on all the socials on at Badass Women's Hour. Now, let's get back to our guest.
I'm going to spend a week inside Tacumbul prison. I'm quite nervous about going in there because it's the most dangerous place in this country.
What is your advice?
Por eso lo que uno no tiene es meter la mano donde no debe meter. Acá hablamos de vida o muerte.
35 prison guards to 4,000 prisoners. I've never seen anything like it in any prison anywhere in the world. What are you looking for?
Comida para vender.
Oh, that's food?
Just wouldn't associate what I'm seeing right now with such a beautiful island.
You have armed officers in the watchtowers.
Yes.
And they have permission to shoot if somebody tries to escape?
Yes.
They have permission to shoot if somebody tries to escape. We might try that here on Badass Women's Hour. XL here on Talk Radio. I'm Harriet Minter and I am talking about the world's toughest prisons. You heard a little clip from the Netflix show there, and we're joined now by the reporter behind it, Raphael Rowe. Hi, Raphael.
Hi, Harriet, and remind me not to switch off before you tell me to so you don't shoot. I'm scared already.
Please, I'm going to be a pussycat compared to what you've been doing. Tell us, first of all, where did the idea to go into the world's toughest prisons come from?
Well, it was conceived by a production company here in the UK called Emporium Productions, who are under the Hattrick stable, who make lots of television programmes. And originally, they made the show for Channel 5 with a different presenter who did a fantastic job. And then Netflix were building up their bank of programmes, and they came in and took the series, but they wanted to change the reporter. And it just so happened that I was in conversation with Emporium about another idea at the time, that we then started talking about using my experience and knowledge of prison and working on this series. And so that's how I got involved, you know. And then it was, you know, taking a taste of tape to Netflix, who sort of said that we want this guy on the show, and it all moved forward from there, really.
And if anyone doesn't know, what is your experience of prison?
Well, I'm a man who spent 12 years in prison of a life sentence for a murder and a series of robberies that I didn't commit. As a 20-year-old, I was convicted here in the UK. I was sentenced to life imprisonment, and I spent the next 12 years in a single cell, you know, trying to architect a campaign to prove that I didn't commit the crimes. 12 years later, with the help of my family, friends, campaigners, the media, my convictions were overturned by the Court of Appeal. I was released, and I've led a successful career as a journalist ever since.
I mean, that in itself is an amazing starting point for going into these prisons around the world and being able to connect with the people in there. But did you feel, when they kind of talked to you about it, were you like, oh, hang on, I've done prison. I'm not sure I want to go back.
It wasn't an easy decision. I mean, it wouldn't be for anybody. I mean, it's different if you're guilty, you've served the sentence, maybe you've got something different to offer. But for me, it was a torturous time. It changed me as a person, my character. It interfered with my relationships in life, my growing up with my family, et cetera, et cetera. You know, from 20 to 32, I was in prison for a crime I didn't commit. So it was a tough decision, but there is a bigger picture here. And it's about showing people what prison is really like. I suppose that's what I'm trying to do in this film. It's about changing people's perceptions, even my own. I learned so much going into these different prisons in different countries because they do it differently. I mean, there's only two things that are the same. One is containment, holding people behind closed walls. And second, it's a form of punishment. And most people are in there for crimes they did commit. Not everyone, but most people are. And they're the only similarities.
For you, in those 12 years, you must have really learnt some, I guess, incredible coping skills for dealing with scary, difficult, confrontational situations. How did those skills help making this show?
Well, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, I looked into the eyes and the face of men that have done horrible things over and over again. That's when I was in prison, and now I do it for a living. I suppose the skill set he gave me was to know when somebody is genuinely threatening me or poses a threat, or whether they're just doing a big I am kind of attitude, and to pick up on people's instincts, their aura. With men, and you've got to remember, mine is a learned experience, having been confined in that space with men where violence was prevalent all of the time. And I've used those skills and my communication with people who have been violent to diffuse, you know, to protect myself or to defend myself. And so I've taken those skills into these prisons around the world. And so I'd like to think that sometimes, you know, I have an advantage. Not every prisoner I speak to in these prisons knows that I've been in prison initially. I mean, that sometimes comes out during the course of the conversation. So sometimes it is used to my advantage. But most importantly, I think I know the aura of many men who have done many things which protect me in these environments.
When you were in prison, did you think that the British prison system was a particularly tough one? If somebody had said, you know, name some of the toughest prisons on earth, would you have put the British prison system up there?
When I was in prison, prison was tough. I mean, I was held in a prison within a prison. I'm talking about 20 years old. You know, I wasn't just in any kind of prison. I was inside a prison, and then within a prison, they had another prison built, and that was in Brixton in London, and I spent 18 months there. Yeah. I was also a high category prisoner, so I was held in single cells in high maximum security prisons all over the country. And I will challenge anyone, Harriet, here or anywhere around the world, who thinks that one prison can be tougher than another for the individual who's being contained in there, because I personally think prison is tough for various different reasons. Even the most rehabilitative prisons that have the most progressive systems and the luxuries, if you like, of PlayStations or TVs in their cells. I mean, the difference really does come down to culture, resources and infrastructure. And in this series, Tuckumbu is probably the worst of the worst I've ever seen. You know, men sleeping outside under cardboard like homeless individuals on the street. It was just shocking. Openly using drugs, carrying knives. You know, they kill each other at least once every 2 weeks. I mean, it was a frightening place. But more than that, it was seeing the social breakdown of such a place that really bothered me.
And so where is Tuckumbu?
Tuckumbu is in Paraguay, Asunción. It's the capital of Paraguay, small Latin South American country. And I've been to a few prisons around South America, Colombia, Brazil. And they do have brutal regimes, prisons run by prisoners. I mean, in this particular place, 35 prison guards to 4,000 prisoners. I mean, that says it all.
I mean, I had a moment of complete shock there when you said 35 prison guards to 4,000 prisoners. How on earth has that situation occurred? How has the government thought this is going to work?
I think they just give up. I think they have this hard line outside of prison that we're going to clamp down on drug traffickers. And what happens is it's not the big guys, as it has happened anywhere in the world. It's not the big drug traffickers and the ones that make the lots of money. It's the small guys on the street that get picked up and get locked up for having possession or for using. And that's what I found in here. I think, you know, a third of the prison population in Tuckumbu were drug users. You know, they didn't need to be locked up, sleeping under cardboard in an open sort of space and on the outside, nothing covering them. They need help, therapy. But it's a country that often throws these kinds of individuals, as well as your hardened criminals. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there were murderers in there, cartel drug trafficking bosses. There were rapists. There were all types of offenders, very violent offenders. I mean, the knives they were showing me was terrifying. But I think the government gives up and it doesn't have the resources. The director in this particular prison did say to me, you know, what the best thing that could happen to this place would be to erase it to the ground, you know, rub it out, that basically, and start again. That would be the best thing for that place. And I believe he's right.
When you go into somewhere like that, presumably it is on those ratios, it must be a prison that is run by the prisoners and they are setting the rules and almost in a way in sort of keeping the structure. how do you start, how do you even know where to start when it comes to who you're going to interview, what the stories are you're going to tell?
It's kind of worked out a little bit beforehand, but mostly once we're in the prison. So I have a team who work extremely hard to get us into the prison. Once we've got the permission, you know, my director or producer, generally one or two people will go into the prison. They will talk to the director about what it is we want to do and how and why we're doing what we're doing. And then they get shown around the prison sort of beforehand. I'm not with them at the time. And during that moment, they sort of take the opportunity to speak to individual prisoners. Now, in a place like Takambu and other prisons I've been to where the prisoners are in control, the guards often hand the director over to the sort of man in charge. And then from there, he builds a little bit of a relationship. A week later, I'll turn up. When I get into the prison, I'm introduced to that boss. And then I try and negotiate with that person of where I can go, what I can do, and then I meet individuals. And it goes from there. It's a lot of ad lib, really. But it's all based on trust, you know, from the very moment I step through those gates, as well as sort of puffing out my chest and trying to be tougher and harder and as fearless as sometimes I appear. I try and use the persona that helped me survive in the real prison during real time in this environment that I've got to be, you know, draw withheld for 7 days. So it's about building trust with the boss of the prison, the guards, and the smaller type prisoners, so that I can navigate with as least problems as possible.
Do you ever feel scared?
There have been occasions where I have genuinely feared for my safety, and in this particular season in Lesotho, I did encounter what was a really frightening moment where prisoners were threatening to rape me. In fact, they were telling me I had to choose one of my cellmates as my wife or become the wife of one of the cellmates, because that's how they do it. That's part of their coping mechanism. But the problem is, before I got into that dormitory, the guard had already said to me, "You're on your own. If anything happens, there's no one to protect you. And if anybody tries to rape you, there's no one to help you." And then I find out, you know, 3/4 of that prison population are in for sexual offences, in particular rape. Most of them have HIV. So, you know, this is a bigger and badder problem than just prisoners. So that was frightening. But again, in Paraguay, we got attacked. I had snooker balls thrown at me by a prisoner. Luckily, it hit the camera of the person filming me and didn't break his jaw or do even more serious damage. So we do face real present threats when we're filming this, and we do as much as we can to protect ourselves.
We've talked about some of the dangers and the, I guess, the scarier sides of doing this job that you're doing. But I also want to talk to you about some of the human stories that you've come across, because there must be people that you meet in there that you find some form of connection with, or whose stories really stick with you.
Yeah, there is, actually. I mean, I try not to judge anybody. I mean, I've sat down with serial killers, men that have killed their own children, you know, multiple rapists who commit murder and some of the wickedest of crimes. But I've also came across, you know, individuals who just come from, you know, poor social backgrounds, or they may be uneducated, or they may have to feed to provide for themselves or their families. And their stories are always really sad. I don't compare them with myself or with anyone else. I take them as an individual, and I try and listen to their story about why. And I always appreciate how candid they can be sharing with me. And I think that's for one reason, you know, beyond the trust. And that's because very rarely do they get asked the simple questions that I'm asking them, like, why did you do what you did, and how do you feel about what you did? And these guys are not often asked that question, or may never have been asked that question before in their life. You know, simply, you know, do they miss their wife, their mother? What does their family think about it? So on that level, I do have a connection, because I have a mother, I have sisters who suffered hellishly when I was in prison, and I could never feel their pain. And so, you know, part of my tactic to try and get these guys to realise that prison is the wrong place, especially those that are savable, if you like, those that can change their mindset, leave prison and maybe never go back. I try to make them think about the consequences, not just of the victims, if it's a victim's crime, but also their family and relatives who have been supporting them and doing what little they can. So I have a connection with them on that level for sure.
Have you come across anyone in your interviews that you think actually might have been wrongly convicted?
Well, I mean, I don't have enough time, if I'm honest, to sort of look into their cases. But without a shadow of a doubt, in Belize, I met numerous guys who were protesting that they were wrongfully imprisoned. And, you know, I like to think that I have an instinct for some guys, and there was genuinely some guys who I believe shouldn't be. I could just see the pain in their face and in their voice, that they weren't just trying to pull the wool over my eyes, especially when they knew that I myself had spent many years in prison for a crime I didn't commit. I could feel that connection. I could feel there was something there. And there is, without doubt, somebody in every prison I've been in up to date who has come to me and sort of said, I shouldn't be here, I've been wrongly convicted. I mean, it's one thing to complain that they shouldn't have been convicted of murder or the offence that they were convicted of, but maybe a lesser offence. But there has been at least one or two individuals and many in other places who have approached me and said, I'm innocent, I shouldn't be here, please help me.
One of the tropes that we often see when we... in prison dramas or in novels about prison is the idea of the corrupt guard. Do you think that the guards you meet are generally, how good do you think they are?
Part of the format of the show is that I spend a day with the guards, so it's a privilege actually to see the other side and talk to them about the challenges they face, you know, and the fact that at the end of the day they've got to go home to their family, and after they've seen someone murdered or something violent or even something good, how do they cope with that? I think it varies in different locations. You know, when I was in Norway and Germany, the guards there are paid so well, they're provided with the right resources, you know, they have the protection of the system, if you like, they have much more control over the prisons. That differs in places like Brazil or Paraguay or Lesotho, where the guards, you know, they're in with the prisoners, you know, they mix and mingle with the guys. Sometimes you don't know who is the prisoner and who is the guard. And yeah, there is a lot of corruption. And the guards are the first ones to admit that, you know, sometimes the only way they can survive or the only way prisoners can survive is to have this corrupt relationship. In Paraguay, guards were charging prisoners to sleep on the floor. So and in other places, they were bringing in drugs for prisoners. And I think this goes over and above that, you know, sort of one-off corrupt prison officer who gets caught and then suspended or expelled from the prison service. I think the lack of security in some of these places allows guards to bring in a lot more than they should. And there's an argument to sort of say whether that's right or wrong. You know, sometimes it might be something as simple as food, bringing in an extra bit of food to give to a prisoner. Now, that would be considered corrupt. But when you're looking at some of these guys who have absolutely nothing, would you... you know, grudge a guard who's doing something as generous as bringing in an apple for a prisoner? I would.
How has it changed your view of the prison system doing this show?
I think it's made me more determined to change people's perceptions, I think. And I think the audience's reaction, the direct reaction that I get from the audience, I'm achieving that. People are messaging me and saying to me that, you know, they were hardline, lock them up, throw away the key, but having seen what they've seen, they've changed their mind and more should be done. I think, you know, I don't want to compare different prisons in different countries because, as I've highlighted on many occasions, you know, the resources and the infrastructure and the types of crimes and the culture and the social deprivation that some of these prisoners come from are the bigger challenges. You know, it's bigger than just comparing prisons to say one's tougher than another or one does it right or one does it wrong. I think prison is just a cog in the criminal justice systems all around the world, and many of them can be improved. And I think that's what I've learned, that many of these criminal justice systems, it doesn't always take finances. Sometimes it's just the sharing of knowledge.
What are some of the things that perhaps you would like to see changed about the UK's criminal system?
Well, the first thing is honesty. I'd like the British government and the British Ministry of Justice and all those that work within our criminal justice system is just to be honest. I mean, they try to, I think, sometimes, but not all the time. They pull the wool over the public's eyes. I think just being honest about what really goes on and paint the true picture of what prisons are like. I think we in this country have the perception that prisons are these wild, violent, spiced, taking places. Well, prisons differ across the country. You know, you have many local prisons where they do have these revolving door challenges, but the majority of long-term prisoners are in completely different type environments, and what goes on in there is very different from what we see on our televisions when we have these short, sharp hit type programs where we sort of say that's crazy, that's mad. So I think being honest is the first thing about what prisons are really like. But to do that, they've got to give people access. And at the moment, I think we over-control the access that we give the media to show the public what their taxpayer money is paying for, you know. And they're terrified of people seeing something like a PlayStation in a prisoner's cell, because then they think, you know, the media will go berserk and the public will go crazy because why should a prisoner have that? Well, I think we just need to explain why a prisoner has that. And sometimes it's because they're banged up behind their door for 23 hours, so it's to keep them sane. Yeah. It's also to create a sort of different atmosphere. So I think being honest and sharing knowledge and experience with other prisons that do it much better than we do.
Do you think as a country, the UK needs to think about how it treats people who have been prisoners, who have come out and who are looking for jobs, looking to change their life, looking to do things differently? Do you think we can start to think about how we change our attitudes?
I think the thing is that I think there's so many charities, organisations out there already doing this, but it's just not joined up. It just frightens me to think how many different organisations are doing exactly the same job. And so it bothers me that it's more of a money ka-ching kind of attitude rather than it is getting, because it's not hard. I mean, really think about it. We have a population of 60 million. We have a prison population of 80,000. The government are talking about building three new maximum prisons, you know, these 1,000 intake prisons. I mean, who are they going to put in these prisons? That suggests to me that they're going to be going out there and taking people off the street to lock them up and criminalizing people, women in particular, who don't need to be criminalized. So I think the issue is much bigger. I think there are some success stories out there. There are a lot of dedicated people out there trying to do the right thing. I think where they get it wrong, both the government, these organizations, is they try to rehabilitate the individual. They need to get into the mindset and make that person believe that they can be somebody else. Once they do that, they've made a change. Less victims, less crime.
That's fascinating. Finally, Raphael, is there anywhere that you haven't been yet on World's Toughest Prisons that you would like to go and look at? Where else do you think the show should go?
Wow, the world is a big place. I mean, yeah, I'd like to keep comparing. You know, I'm half Caribbean. My dad's from Jamaica. I'd love to go and see inside a prison in Jamaica to see how they feel. I'd love to go to Australia and see what it's like down the other side of the world. In India, I haven't been into India. So I've almost touched every continent. But I think, you know, yeah, those are the places I'd like to go. But you know what? Sometimes it's in your own backyard. And I would love for the British government to say, come and spend 7 days in our prisons, even though I spent 12 years trying to get out. I'd still go back because I think I could show the real side of what goes on.
I think you could too. Raphael, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us. It's absolutely fascinating listening to you. And just a really interesting insight there, I think, into a prison society around the world, but also how we see the prison population, how we see people who have been in prison, and how we can start to address those own attitudes within ourselves.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast. You can get in touch on all the socials on at Badass Women's Hour.
We are talking all things badass women on this show, and our next guest is, I think, pretty much the definition of one. She's written her first novel at the age of 78, and it's inspired by her work as a consultant psychiatrist. Brenda Davies joins us to talk about it now. Hi, Brenda.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining us. Your first novel is The Girl Behind the Gates, and mm-hmm. it tells the story of a girl who, at the age of 17, finds herself pregnant but unmarried in 1939 mm-hmm. and ends up being sectioned. How did you find... where did the inspiration come from for this story?
Well, it's a true story. I lived part of it. Yeah, it's a true story, although, of course, I've changed names and dates and places in order to protect people's anonymity. But pretty well everything about it is true, part of it taken from Nora's notes and things, and the rest of it, yeah, I lived through.
You say you lived through. Tell us about that.
Well, I was a young consultant psychiatrist in this hospital and came across Nora in my work on the back wards. And like so many of my patients, she was such an inspiration. And I'm often saying to people, you know, their stories are so amazing and really they should write their stories. So I said to Nora several times, you really need to write your story. And she said, no, I can't. But maybe you'd write it for me. And I said, no, that's not what I'm doing. And I refused many times. And then she was very, very clever and sweetly manipulative in that she died in 1995 and she left a letter saying, Brenda, don't forget you promised to write my story. So I sat on it for quite a long time. And then I thought, since I am indeed 79, actually, in 10 days' time, I needed to get on with it now. So about 3 years ago, I decided, okay, this is the time if I'm going to do it. And it's been an absolute joy to write her story and remember her. And I'm sure that she's thrilled too. She wanted her story to be told, particularly so that it might also bear witness to the other women who were in similar positions. Because actually at the time, that time, there were still about 2,700 women in psychiatric hospitals up and down the length of England who had been incarcerated because they were unmarried mothers. Wow. They were incarcerated under the Mental Deficiency Act, which covered people like sex workers, we would call them now, prostitutes they were called then, people with alcohol problems, sometimes people with learning disabilities and unmarried mothers. And so that was the category she came into. And at that time, there would, of course, be a choice because she also tried to kill herself at that time. Mm. And there would have been a choice between prison, because she had now two criminal offences, or psychiatric hospital. And her parents said psychiatric hospital. But, of course, her sentence, if you like, was open-ended, and she was there for many, many years.
How old was she when you met her?
She was just turning 60 or thereabouts, and she'd been there since she was 17. So, yeah, it was dreadful. She was 66 when she eventually got free.
I mean, I can't almost believe that. How did... At no point in those 50 years, somebody say, hang on, we need to look at this.
Well, the thing is that they didn't have any of the facilities that we have now. Mm. Even in the 1980s, there weren't all of the facilities that we had now. And so everybody was treated as a naughty children, particularly these women. They were just bad girls.
Yeah.
And treated as such. And nobody, you know, the diagnosis she had was moral defective. Mm. A terrible, terrible term.
Yeah.
Nobody looked at what was really going on with this young girl. But in fact, when she was admitted to hospital, there was nothing going on with her.
Yeah.
Sure, she was pregnant and she was frightened. But apart from that, she was not mentally ill. It was being there for so long and suffering the treatment that she suffered, that most of the patients suffered, actually, during that time, that actually produced complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which was eventually what was diagnosed. And so she'd suffered depression quite a lot just by being there, and the things that she suffered and the degradation and humiliation there was in those days. And, yeah, and she was catatonic from time to time. Mm. But I want the story to be seen as it really, truly is, one of certainly women's rights, mental health, but also about the amazing power and resilience of the human spirit, because that was really what she stands for.
And what I think is incredible is you say she was finally released at age 66.
Mm.
And she went on to have a happy life? Is that...
She did. She did extremely well. I don't want to spoil the book too much. but, yeah, she did extremely well. She worked very hard, and she regained some pride in herself. But, of course, I would imagine that right until the end of her life, she probably still suffered flashbacks occasionally and still had nightmares occasionally. But in terms of her life as it had been, she was much, much better, and she found joy again in life. Mm. But her life that could have been, well, that's a different matter.
Do you think... This is obviously, you know, we're talking about something that happened in 1939 and here we are in 2020.
Yeah.
But do you still think in 2020 that there is a gendered aspect to how we talk about mental health? I'm thinking of, you know, things like we now talk about postnatal depression quite openly, but that still feels like a relatively recent thing for me.
You know, yeah.
Are we still inclined to... maybe not put the same kind of moral defective label on women and their behaviour, but still judge women differently when it comes to mental health?
I think probably, I was going to say possibly, but probably we do. I don't want in any way, though, to demonise psychiatry. I think that psychiatry, well practiced, is a beautiful art. Yeah. But I do think that we can, if we have time, and of course time is often of the essence of working in the NHS particularly, but if we can have time to really listen to people's story, for me it's all about story. I love people's stories, and I feel that, you know, we are a sum total of everything that ever happened to us, and if we have time to go back and find the story, listen to the story, see why one thing happened after another, and how this person got to here, then often just in the telling of their story, there's an enormous amount of healing that can happen. And, of course, nowadays we also have psychotropic medication, which is far, far different to anything there was. When, at the time that Nora was admitted, there would be things like phenobarbital, well, other barbiturates, and not a lot else, really. So straitjackets and such were the way that people were controlled, because it was all about custodial care and control of people who were often apparently uncontrollable. Mm. And, of course, people who are psychotic, then they would be uncontrollable and, you know, would be tortured by their hallucinations and things, whereas now we do have medication that helps with that. But I still think we need to look at people's story. So I'm a great believer in psychotherapy and also healing to help people really, really find out who they are and work to become better versions of themselves, and also to work to forgive. Yeah. I think so much of the things that people are left with, the trauma that they still carry, we can deal with a lot of that by teaching people.
Brenda, thank you so much. There's an incredible story there, and she tells it brilliantly. The book is The Girl Behind the Gates. Go buy it now.
You've been listening to Badass Women's Hour. If you like the show, then help more people find us. You can tag us or talk to us on social media using @BadassWomen'sHour, or you can be really lovely and leave us a review and a rating. 5 stars, please. It helps boost us up the podcast rankings and allows other people to find us. We'll be back next week with more badass guests and in-depth chat.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.